Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts. Hey, it's Francis. You know, this week we are bringing back one of my favorite episodes from last year. Actually, one of my favorite episodes we've ever done. It's about Chinese-American food. Long live the great general, so check it out. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. So, on my left arm is the first tattoo I ever got. It's three little illustrations, the instructions on how to use chopsticks. You know, the ones printed on the little paper sleeves the disposable chopsticks come in from your local Golden Panda Garden Empress Express or whatever. And I got them because, honestly, because it's kind of funny to get a tattoo of instructions on how to hold chopsticks. But, I mean, have you ever tried to follow those instructions? Like, even with those drawings, it is impossible, impossible to learn how to use chopsticks by following those instructions. But it's also why I love them. In fact, it's why I'm inspired by them. Because, look, if you're in a Chinese restaurant where the clientele doesn't already know how to use chopsticks, chances are, you know, that restaurant is not there to show off its culinary genius. Right? Chances are it's just a place for an immigrant family to make a living so that their kids can grow up to do something else. And yet, even in that purely commercial, transactional place, you know, the people who run them still offer you chopsticks. They offer you a bit of their culture, a bit of something that makes them who they are. And you know, in my mind, the fact that the instructions on how to use them are not easy to follow is part of the power of the metaphor for me. It's an attempt to connect. And isn't that what a society rich with immigrants is supposed to be trying to do with each other all the time? So anyway, this week, we are talking about Chinese-American food. Not just the dishes, although we'll get into some of those, but more like the world of the Chinese-American restaurant. It's a subject that is so near and dear to my heart, I feel like we could do 1,000 segments on it. But today, we're just going to start with two. Later in the show, we're going to talk with the Ng family, who run Bo Ling's restaurant for nearly 40 years in Kansas City. And first, we'll talk and take your cooking questions with Lucas Sin. Lucas is the chef of Junzi Kitchen. It's a small chain, a tiny chain, really, of modern, fast-casual Chinese restaurants. He's a native of Hong Kong, and he really knows his stuff when it comes to traditional Hong Kong Cantonese cuisine. But when he got to America, he realized that he was relentlessly curious about how Chinese food evolves as it travels the world, so much so that he wants to save the very restaurants that most Chinese food snobs would never touch. Hey, Lucas, it's great to talk with you.
Thanks for having me, Francis.
So I really want to ask you this because you grew up in Hong Kong, like you first became a chef in Hong Kong, and then you moved to the U.S. So what was your first impression of Chinese American food or American Chinese food, however you want to describe it?
American Chinese food, I suppose. My first memory of American Chinese food was a dude with a bunch of styrofoam boxes just giving them out for like $5 a pop out of the back of his like Toyota Camry or whatever it was.
Really?
And we were, I had spent this summer going to summer school here in the US. And I remember like on Wednesdays, late night at like 10 o'clock, this guy would just pull up and he'd just like start handing these boxes out for $5 a pop. And I remember it being super, super tightly packed, like an enormous amount of food. I remember it being so delicious. Like I would look forward to it every week.
Really?
And it was just so affordable and so, there is so much comfort in it. And I wish I could say it was unrecognizable, but some of it was, you know, like some of it was like familiar. There's, mm-hmm. you know, the sweet and sour flavors, a generous amount of rice, meat that's mixed in with vegetables and General Tso's chicken and sesame chicken. The most remarkable thing perhaps to me when I was like maybe 14 years old or something, the first time I had this American Chinese food was, the fact that it was all so similar to each other. That's, to me, sesame chicken was so similar structurally to General Tso's chicken. It was so similar to all these other fried chickens tossed in sweet and sour sauce. It took me a long time to sort of like really understand the nuance between these sauces and to see that there was a difference. But yeah, that was my first sort of experience. I will say that I had sort of a couple of other revelatory American Chinese cuisine sort of like experiences. There are two that come to mind. The first is in Michigan. So my girlfriend is from Michigan, and we go back for Thanksgiving every year. And the highlight, other than the Thanksgiving dinner, is this tiny restaurant in this mall called Little Easy, which is an amazing name for a restaurant. It's called Little Easy. Yeah. They are about to go out of business because a Sears in that mall just went out of business. But they make this thing called bourbon chicken, which is very, very similar, I suppose, to teriyaki. I don't know if there is any bourbon in it, but it's this sort of like glazed chicken. And again, you know, when you order it, you're like, hey, I'll take the bourbon chicken over rice. They just like grab this, the largest shovel you've ever seen in your life, and just start heaping it on. Like the portion is amazing, right? The other remarkable experience is actually in some terminal of JFK. I was flying back home to Hong Kong. There was like nothing else to eat. There were like three Shake Shacks. I was like, you know what the heck? Let's get Panda Express. And I had Panda Express.
The OG, man.
Yeah. And walnut shrimp is a delicious dish. it is an insane dish. I don't know if now is the time. We're jumping ahead a little bit. Here's the story for walnut shrimp, right? So I cook now in the U.S., but I try to spend a month every year cooking in China. And so it's kind of almost like a sabbatical type of thing where it's basically a stage, right? It's an apprenticeship, and I try to go to China, figure out what's going on, learn different regional cuisines.
Yeah.
One of these months, I'm in northern China. I'm in Dongbei, and I'm cooking for this fancy restaurant. And it's like my last day, and they say, hey, so this is the graduation dish. And I was like, what's a graduation dish? They say, oh, if you were, you know, theoretically in culinary school or something, this is the dish to test your skill. And the dish is a couple of shrimps. You butterfly them so they're nice and open, and then you pan them kind of thin. You deep fry them really, really gently. The key here is not to get it crispy, but to get the thinnest possible batter on your shrimp. So you have deep fried butterfly shrimp. And then you put some raw white sugar into the wok, and you, at a very low heat, you turn that sugar into a syrup that you toss your fried shrimp in. And then the idea is that every piece of shrimp is coated in the thinnest possible layer of batter and the thinnest possible layer of sugar. As it cools down, you put it on the plate, it's, you know, that sugar crystallizes. And then
it's crackly, yeah.
It gets crackly, and then it preserves that crispiness, right? So this is, according to this guy I was cooking with, the most difficult dish in all of Northeast China, right? And then I'm at JFK, I'm eating this honey walnut shrimp because Panda Express looked at this dish and said, let's scale it up to 2,000 locations. Let's serve this at all of our restaurants, which is insane. And people don't give enough credit to that, you know? Like, I was at Panda Express the other day, like, I'm at their headquarters in Pasadena, and chatting with the food team there, and they're like, yeah, we take, you know, this is how much care we take into scaling things up. And people don't understand how hard it is to put these new dishes on there because no one else is doing it. I'm honestly, I think this sort of is a segue into the rest of the conversation, but I'm really, really impressed by this sort of like audacity to like scale up Chinese food and look at dishes and say, yeah, we can do this at a high quality in a lot of different places and hopefully change people's sort of impression of what Chinese food can be in the US.
Well, this is incredible because, you know, you're coming to this from the perspective of someone, you know, who grew up in Hong Kong, who left there not that long ago, because you said you left there when you were like 14, and I think you're like 16 now.
Pretty much.
You know, so like your memories of like, you know, food from like the motherland are still very clear. And you're a chef, but you have so much respect. Like, you put so much shine on this American Chinese food. And I think it's interesting for a lot of reasons. Well, you know, one is like, so when I was growing up, like my parents came here, got here in the 70s, right? And and we had this other kind of relationship to Chinese restaurants. Like, they worked in Chinatown, so we always had access to the food they recognized from Hong Kong, you know, where they were from. But basically, whenever we would see the Chinese restaurants that were, you know, the Golden Empress or, you know, the Dragon Garden or, you know, the Panda Takeout or whatever, they would always say that they were there to akwailo,
Yeah.
Right? That their food was meant to trick foreigners. That's literally what that phrase means, right? And so, like, you know, now as an adult, I kind of, you know, I side-eye people a little bit who want to, like, position themselves as authenticity police. But we were that way for sure. But you really embrace this from, you know, as you were just talking about, from a technical point of view to, like, scale it. But you're also talking about, like, the nuances between the sauce of sesame chicken, Generoso's chicken, sweet and sour chicken, which to me, honestly, are, they're all the same. They just have a different name.
Yeah.
But you're talking about the nuances between those two. So, like, do you have a sense of why you saw this food and you respected it and you wanted to learn about it rather than think of it as being, you know, like a bastardized version of Chinese food, which is what, you know, a lot of people who are, you know, authenticity police think of it as?
Yeah, I am so sick and tired of people telling me that American Chinese food made by Chinese Americans for the last 100 to 200 years or whatever it is inauthentic. It's such a silly way to characterize a cuisine that spurred on, you know, generations of immigration. The last I counted before COVID, it was 46,000 Chinese restaurants in the U.S. Yeah. That's almost double the last number I heard. So the way we got that number is we scraped Yelp to see how many restaurants tagged themselves as Chinese and stuff. And it's like 40-something thousand. And it's just that amount of cuisine. You know, this is the second most delivered food in the U.S. after pizza, and you're just going to tell me that it's inauthentic? You know, people are eating this regularly, right? Every day. They eat this more often than they eat meatloaf, and you're going to say it's inauthentic. It is so silly. I think this sort of understanding needs to come from two things. First is a place of respect, right? You have to understand that these are real human beings that are cooking this food. And I think the respect for the people who are making the food, number one. And second of all, a careful study of history, right? When you start to understand how important this cuisine was in shaping sort of American history and like the way human beings live their lives, how people found their livelihood, then it's really, really hard for you to not study it. Because the more you look into the history, you realize that Chinese food is ridiculously efficient. It behaves almost by its own rules. Like the Chinese food industry is almost separate from a lot of the regular food industry. I'll give you an example. Chinese restaurants oftentimes source from distributors that are all over the U.S. They don't rely on these big distributors that a lot of other sort of like chain-ish type of scaled restaurants, restaurants need.
Cisco's and the...
So these smaller distributors purchase ingredients from oftentimes smaller farms. And a lot of these farms are, you know, immigrant owned or they're Asian run. Mm-hmm. So small distributors working with small farms for these tiny, tiny restaurants. And these mom and pop shops then are able oftentimes to get very high quality produce because it's kind of like a decentralized, scalable supply chain, right? You don't have a big, you know, you don't have a big headquarters in Illinois telling you what to do. The same applies for the recipes. Despite the fact that there's so much Chinese food everywhere, and there is a remarkable similarity between the sesame chicken in Arizona and the sesame chicken in New York, despite that fact, there is no headquarters saying this is the recipe. All this information just passed through this, you know, this diaspora, right? This network, whoever's cousin from Fujian, and everyone seems to know how to do these things as a mode of survival. And when you look at that as a you know, entrepreneur, as a business owner, as a chef, you start asking yourself, what can I learn from here? You learn a lot of business efficiency. You learn a lot of like really cool techniques to preserve texture in particular, or to enhance something to make it more deliverable. Like all of these techniques just come from, you know, a deep look at how American Chinese food is actually made and how it got to where it is today. And I think to this day, I love to consider myself as a student of American Chinese cuisine. A reporter was speaking with me a little while ago, and they quoted me as saying, if Steve Ells, you know, the founder Chipotle had spent some time, you know, at Wohup, if he had spent some time in a Chinese restaurant, Chipotle's probably would look pretty different because business-wise, there's a lot to learn there.
Lucas Sin is the chef of Junzi Kitchen and Nice Day in New York City and New Haven, Connecticut. Stick around, he's going to help us answer your cooking questions after the break. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Our show is supported by Hero Bread. You know, for a lot of us, bread has been a staple all our lives. Toast at breakfast, sandwiches at lunch, a nice buttered roll at dinner. It's comforting and delicious, and bread is often what we crave, but sometimes it can sit a little heavy after a meal. That's where Hero Bread comes in. They've created fluffy, delicious versions of the breads that we're used to,
but that include no net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and fewer calories. Oh, and there's more good stuff too, like protein and fiber. Hero Bread has everything from your daily sandwich loaf to tortillas or hot dog and hamburger buns. The products are flavorful and they have something for every craving, from a dressed-up breakfast burrito to a late-night PB&J. They even have monthly small-batch drops of indulgent treats like 2-gram net-carb Hero Croissant or the 1-gram net-carb Hero Cheddar Biscuit. Don't give up being a breadhead. Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code TABLE at checkout. That's table at hero.co. Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its 4th season. In every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking an amazing meal. Listen as Ina does what she does best, make good conversation and delicious food, while making it sound fun and easy. This season, Ina dives into conversation with astronaut and colonel Nicole Mann. As Ina teaches Nicole how to make seared scallops with celery root puree, they talk about everything from family to what foods Nicole really craves when she's in space. And listen in as Ina and Pulitzer Prize-winning writer David Remnick talk about music lessons and the value of developing language skills before joining their spouses for a lively conversation over a comforting dish of chicken parmesan. If you love a good chat over a great meal, you'll love Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. We've been talking to Lucas Sin, chef of Junzi Kitchen and Nice Day, about Chinese-American food, and now we're going to get to your questions about cooking Chinese food. And if you have questions for us for a future show, including questions about Thanksgiving Day, it is not too early. Record them as a voice memo on your phone and email them to contact@splendidtable.org. Now let's get back to Lucas. So, like you said, there are 46,000 or something like that Chinese restaurants in the country. Famously, there are more Chinese restaurants than there are McDonald's. But a lot of these places are falling out of favor, right? They're not fashionable. They are family businesses, and oftentimes, you know, the goal of an immigrant family business, frankly, is for you to make enough money to send your kids off to college so they would never have to do what you have to do, right? So a lot of these businesses are, these restaurants are being run by, frankly, elderly people, you know, people who have been running them for 30, 40, 50 years. You and your business partners are doing a really interesting thing. You have raised a $5 million fund to buy out some of these old American Chinese restaurants to let the owners retire. Tell us about that.
So one way to characterize what's happening with Chinese American restaurants is as a crisis, right? Over, and these are numbers before COVID. In New York alone, I think it was in the last year or two, 16% of all Chinese restaurants have closed. 16%, right, of thousands, right? That's insane. And you're right that the first thing to remark is that it is in some ways a good thing, because if your kids are doctors, they don't need to be making beef and broccoli, you know?
That was your dream. That was what you got it for.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what they wanted. My two cents is that I'd like to preserve that heritage that is left there. Again, there's so much to learn from Chinese American cooking and Chinese food in general. To take a step back, I think my personal goal in life is to show the rest of the world how much you can learn from Chinese cuisine, period. Like, I'd love to see, you know, fine dining Italian chefs draw from Chinese cuisine as often as they draw from Japanese cuisine, as often as they draw from French cuisine. But on the other side of the coin is also that it presents a really great sort of business opportunity, because what you're looking at here is a highly, highly demanded type of food that, unfortunately, the supply is dwindling. The supply specifically in this case are the people who are running the restaurants. The same thing that made American Chinese restaurants so efficient, which is, you know, a reliance on a sort of insular network of cooks and ingredients and recipes and things, is also a unique obstacle to Chinese American restaurants. Because when you're getting older and you'd like to retire, nobody wants to buy up that restaurant anymore. And there are these sort of spaces that are set up perfectly for cooking a certain type of food that, unfortunately, you know, Starbucks doesn't know what to do with. You know, you can't, it's a lot harder for other sort of types of cuisines to move into a Chinese restaurant.
Oh, interesting.
So that plus the fact that I think that there's something worth preserving about serving sort of quality, scalable, and sort of like updated Chinese food all throughout the U.S., and I want to be very careful when I use the word sort of like updated. I just think that a lot of Chinese food in the U.S. needs to be brought up to sort of like modern standards. By modern standards, I mean like demands of the consumer and the customers. For example, they might want a little bit more transparency to see how the food is being made, right? They might want some food to be less sodium heavy. It needs to fit their sort of like nutritional needs, for example.
Sure.
What I do not mean is I definitely don't mean that Chinese American food needs to be elevated.
Yeah.
I will say that
that's,
there are a lot
that's
of
such like, a gnarly word.
It is. There are a lot of stabs. You know, we've seen people take stabs at trying to elevate American Chinese food, but they don't really get it. American Chinese food doesn't need to be elevated. It just needs to be tweaked to fit how people want to eat these days.
Right.
Elevation sort of assumes that the person elevating it has a higher than thou type of position.
Right.
And they know better.
Right.
And they really don't, right? Because if you were to take that sort of position, you'd be blind to the efficiencies within the business that, you know, history has already set up for you. And we talked a lot about this sort of like business efficiency. I'll give you an example. A standard Chinese-American restaurant is run by three people who work 5 or 6 days a week. The amazing thing, if you know anything about restaurants, is that most American Chinese restaurants, people don't come in unless the restaurant's open, which is to say they don't have any prep hours. Nobody has to come in the morning to cut vegetables, you know, before opening. You do all of your prep while you're cooking. And there are, generally speaking, about, you know, three or maybe four positions inside of the restaurant. You know, there's a wok cook, and then there's like a guy who's cutting vegetables and doing just making fried rice all day and that sort of thing. But the most impressive is right in the front. And this is usually the lady, that, you know, the mom of the mom and pop standing in the front of the store. This is the person who takes all of the phone calls, right, to take all of those orders, dispatch all of those deliveries. They also pack all the bags. They also fry all the spring rolls, steam all the dumplings, and, you know, roast the ribs in the broiler. All that at the same time. And it's because of, you know, physically how that space is set up in the front, right? The fries are right next to the cash register or whatever. And these moms in these mom and pop shops are so, so, so impressive. They're some of the most efficient workers I've ever seen in the restaurant space. And that position is called Xiao Mei, like, you know, little sister in the front.
Yeah.
What other type of restaurant have you heard that has a position like that? That someone who's front of house and deep frying, right? You know, it's crazy.
And I love it.
Right? And if you were to say, okay, like, what's good about this position and how do I absorb this into a modern type of Chinese restaurant? You want to preserve that type of efficiency, then suddenly you have a lot more sort of a restaurant that's actually feasible given the cost that, you know, it takes to run a restaurant these days. And I think our goal at Nice Day is to start asking ourselves how we can bring sort of Chinese American restaurants up to date while still maintaining a deep respect for the heritage that it set up for itself.
Oh man, I love it. And I love that you're preserving it. It's not just like, let me make it cool and make it chefy.
Yeah.
It's like, no, I want to keep it as straight up as it is because I respect
it.
Yeah. All right, I want to go to some calls with you because we also have a lot of listeners who knew we were going to talk with you today and they're like, oh, I have this question about this dish I've always wanted to make and maybe Lucas can help me out with it. You ready to take some calls with me?
Absolutely.
All right. Let's go to Leslie because I think this is it's pretty basic, but I think it'll be helpful for a lot of people.
Hi, this is Leslie Eagle of Lake George, New York. One of my favorite easy meals that I like to make is a simple wok stir fry using a protein and the fresh veggies as a way to clean out my refrigerator. My dilemma is always the sauce. Do you have an easy go-to sauce that I could make with less than 5 ingredients? Oh, and I always have fresh ginger at hand. Thanks.
Thanks, Leslie. Stir fries. Big question.
it's funny because, you know, I think for people who grew up with Chinese cooking, a stir fry is not a dish, right? It's like, it's just a technique.
It's a technique, yeah.
But I totally understand it. She's talking about like a format of a dish, right? She has a little bit of sliced chicken. She's got, say, some cabbage she sliced up. And obviously the sauces should change depending on what your vegetables and what your protein are. But like, to me, this is awesome. Almost a question of like, what should be in your pantry, Like, what are like go-to items you should have in your pantry, and then some ways to mix them and ratios to mix them in?
Yeah. The other thing with stir fries, I think, that sometimes somehow was lost in translation here in the U.S. is that this idea that Chinese food has sauces. We don't think of sauce in Chinese cooking the way we think of sauce in French cooking, right? In many stir fries, you'll add liquid to the pan or to the wok to incorporate into your ingredients, into your dish, but you won't really have a puddle of sauce in the bottom. When you're aiming for a puddle of sauce, the issue is when you're adding too much liquid, oftentimes you lower the temperature of the pan a little bit too much, and you lose some of that wok flavor, right? Some of that stir fry. Most of the flavor of the stir fry, I would say, comes from, number one, your aromatics. And number two, when you're tossing, when you're physically stir frying, you have this sort of like char in the bottom of your pan, but you also have the fumes and the sort of like steam coming off of that food, sort of perfuming itself as it's jumping up and down. So it's great that Leslie mentioned ginger, because ginger is a really great starting point. The other common aromatics, obviously, are garlic and scallion. So if not all of the stir fries I do at home, always start with some activation of ginger, garlic, and scallion. And by activating it, it means if it's an aromatic, it needs to smell good. So you get your pan hot, you get your oil hot, and then you throw in a little bit of garlic, ginger, and scallion until it smells good, and then you add the rest of your ingredients, usually your protein first and then your vegetables. As for the liquids, the sort of so-called sauce, I think the ones that we reach for the most are light soy sauce and dark soy sauce. There's a distinction there. One's for light soy sauce is for sodium. Dark soy sauce is for color. The other ones I would keep in my pantry are oyster sauce.
Yeah.
And my personal hack for oyster sauce is actually there's this thing called abalone sauce. And abalone sauce is basically, it's sauce that you used to cook abalone with. Sometimes it has traces of abalone in there, scallops, that sort of thing, but oftentimes it's just kind of a very reduced kind of chicken and pork stock. If you're Chinese and you've had abalone, canned abalone before, this is the stuff that's on the side of the can. It's really, really, really delicious. And I use abalone at home instead of oyster sauce because I think oyster sauce is a little bit too heavy for me. And I love abalone as a substitute. That's kind of a little hack that I have too. One thing I would say that I really don't think goes into stir fries 90% of the time, the way we're thinking of stir fries as protein plus veggie, is sesame oil. I think it's a little bit too pungent. And in dishes like beef and broccoli, for example, there isn't really a place for that nuttiness.
And sesame oil for me, like, I never used it to cook growing up. It was always...
It's a finishing thing, you know?
Yeah, it mostly lives on the table more than it does in the kitchen. And it's... Maybe there's a soup or a noodle that you want to just like finish with a little bit of it just for that nuttiness.
Yeah. Sesame oil also loses a lot of its aroma when you heat it up, in my opinion. And so if you are adding it to like a noodle sauce or something, it's just, you know, as you say, it's right at the end. So it doesn't encounter too much heat. And from my experience, I think sesame oil has a lot more use in sort of like cold dishes too. Like, you know, salads and... cold sesame noodles and stuff like that.
Yeah, delicious with cucumbers. It's just a great little finish.
Yeah.
Okay, since we're talking about the sort of act of stir frying, I want to go to a question from Britt.
Hey, I'm calling in from Cleveland. I was wondering, because I've really been getting into Chinese cooking lately, do I need a wok to make a lot of these dishes that I want to make? Or is it okay if I just use a normal pan? Thank you.
I want to hear you talk about this, Lucas, because when I see you do a lot of your cooking videos on Instagram, I don't see a wok in your kitchen. You're often using a flat saute pan.
Yeah.
I don't have a wok in my kitchen either, although I would dearly love one, because I don't feel like I have like the right stove for it. But can you talk about it?
I think you've already talked about it. You've like nailed all the points. I do not use a wok in my home kitchen. So, really quick signs about how woks work, right? Woks are supposed to be round bottom pans that sit in a sort of like a wok cavern, right? Like it feels like a jet on an airplane.
Yeah.
And that thing is so hot. I think I'm going to get my numbers wrong, but it's at least 17,000 BTUs in most restaurants. And you're hitting temperatures of upwards of like 700 degrees, right? So it's really, really, really hot. And you're never going to get that at home.
Right.
So the question is, how do you approximate that temperature, right? And that's why I use a pan. I use carbon steel pans. Carbon steel pans are made from the same material as woks are made of, which means that they're really, really conductive, and they also hold in a lot of heat. But because you have a nice flat bottom, you can get as much surface area as possible to absorb that heat that's coming off of your stove. That's why I like to use flat-bottomed, high-walled carbon steel pans to do things like stir fries in. By and large, I think with the types of stove that we have at home, I would strongly recommend just using a skillet or something and working on the technique to keep flipping it and keep it moving rather than worry too much about what type of pan you use. And then when you want to upgrade, go look into a carbon steel pan because those suckers are really, really great. And they behave very similarly to woks, I think.
Yeah, it's the tossing, right?
It is the tossing, yeah.
I think the difference in the cooking is I was trained in, you know, essentially a Western French style kitchen. So the idea is you always want to sear. Like you want to sear, you want to get the browning because it's like sitting there still on the bottom of the pan. You don't want to move it too much. That's not how you approach wok cooking. Mm-hmm. You actually want to make sure it's moving.
And I would say that Kenji Lopez has an amazing article out in the New York Times about wok hei, about this act of wok cooking.
Yeah.
And in short, it's about when you're cooking the wok, the tossing is that when the food hits the pan, it starts cooking, right, by conduction. The heat goes by conduction, and it's a very quick sear. Right? And then as it jumps up, the steam is released into the air, and it sort of like perfumes the food that's above it. And then it's just like sear, and it stops cooking. It starts cooking and stops cooking. And that action, you can sort of imagine it as like a high temperature cooking of just the surface of the food, like constantly. So first of all, it's even. And second of all, there's no sort of steaming. So the food shouldn't really get mushy or anything if you're tossing it in the air consistently enough. And that's sort of what creates a lot of those delicious sort of like wok hei flavors of wok cooking. And to do that at home, you need to be cooking at a very high heat, and you need to be moving the food around a lot.
Right. Exactly. Okay, let's go. We have time for one more. And let's go to Miguel.
Hey, this is Miguel calling in from Albuquerque. I was wondering, because I love fried rice so much and I always have to go out to get it, if there's any good recipes you can give me and any good tips you can give me for how to make really solid homemade fried rice.
Oh, man, this question is made for me, Miguel. So, my claim to fame. And this is like 20,000 Instagram followers out of nowhere claim to fame. Is this recipe I have for golden fried rice. So, if you come to my Instagram, I have a pretty detailed sort of, show and tell sort of video on it. If you look for the golden fried rice in the stories. But golden fried rice is the greatest hack for fried rice of all time, in my opinion. And once again, it comes from a deep understanding, not a deep understanding, but at least like paying attention to Chinese food. And also, you know, drawing the connection between American Chinese dishes and their Chinese origins, which is actually something we didn't get to talk about earlier. But, you know, with dishes like fried rice, sweet and sour pork, one of the key parts of our research before we open Nice Day is to look at where did these techniques come from? And is there anything we can bring in from sort of like Chinese cooking? Mm-hmm. And so golden fried rice is, it's leftover rice. That's the key to any fried rice recipe, golden or not. You want your rice after it's cooked properly with less water than you normally cook it with. You want that surface moisture to evaporate. So the best way to do that is after it's being cooked, out of a rice cooker, for example, to fan it out on a sheet pan or actually fan it out on even a plate and just let that initial moisture evaporate and then just keep it in your fridge overnight before you cook with it. Then you'll get sort of more crumbly, we call it like Lily Fleming rice, where every single grain is separate from each other. And then the nice hack that I think is helpful for home cooks often is I crack an egg yolk into the rice. Egg yolks are awesome because they're a lot of lipids. The fat in the egg yolks helps lubricate the rice so that it actually ends up coating each and every single grain. So you have this nice egg flavor in your rice, but also it helps it separate. And that's the key for fried rice. It's all about this sort of like textural triumph of loose rice that's deeply flavored. So that's basically it. You toss your rice in egg yolks. You sort of crumble it until it's nice and loose. And then you stir fry that rice with, I usually do a little bit of onion, garlic, ginger, and scallion. And then whatever proteins and vegetables you have lying around.
Love it.
And no soy sauce. Absolutely no soy sauce. My goodness.
Thank you for saying it.
Just salt and sugar.
Thank you for saying it. Thank you for saying it. I mean, okay, I'll be completely honest. Sometimes when I'm at home, I'll add a little soy sauce, but it hurts my heart when I see like rice come out brown.
Yeah.
It's like, it's not supposed to be that color, people. Come on.
Yeah. It's supposed to look rice colored.
It's supposed to look rice colored.
Yeah. Or for golden fried rice, you know, the funny thing is actually the way I learned about golden fried rice was through anime. There's this amazing show I grew up watching, called Chuka Ichiban, which is, translates to number one Chinese. And it's a Japanese anime about a Chinese kid who must be 14 years old or something, but he battles his way through China, cooking Chinese food. And in season one, episode one, you know, he's going up against this big imperial chef, and the imperial chef makes a super, super complicated dish, and he just presents the emperor with a bowl of rice that's got nothing in it except for eggs, right? And it's golden fried rice. And when he presents it, you know, the lid comes off, and then there's just beam to heaven of just like of gold, and then everyone's hair is flying. And like, oh my God. And it's just like, I can't believe this is just rice and eggs. And when you come around to making this dish, Miguel, I'm sure you'll feel that way too. It is really, really, it's just so simple, and there's nothing in it. And when there's no soy sauce to kind of like obstruct the aromatics, you can really just taste, you know, garlic and ginger and scallion and onions, and you're only seasoning it with salt. I think it's a really, really beautiful dish and perfect for the home kitchen.
Perfect. You know, I've never made golden fried rice myself. I've had it a million times, but
yeah,
this weekend it's happening. It's on.
Yeah. Take us out. It's so easy.
Thanks, brother. It's great talking with you.
No worries.
Lucas Sin is the chef of Junzi Kitchen and Nice Day in New York City, New Haven, Connecticut. And he's a terrific follow on Instagram. You should really check him out. Coming up, we'll talk with the Ings, a legendary family of Chinese restaurateurs in Kansas City. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Our show is supported by Hero Bread. You know, for a lot of us, bread has been a staple all our lives. Toast at breakfast, sandwiches at lunch, a nice buttered roll at dinner. It's comforting and delicious, and bread is often what we crave, but sometimes it can sit a little heavy after a meal. That's where Hero Bread comes in. They've created fluffy, delicious versions of the breads that we're used to, but that include no net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and fewer calories. Oh, and there's more good stuff too, like protein and fiber. Hero Bread has everything from your daily sandwich loaf to tortillas or hot dog and hamburger buns. The products are flavorful, and they have something for every craving, from a dressed-up breakfast burrito to a late-night PB&J. They even have monthly small-batch drops of indulgent treats like 2-gram net-carb Hero Croissant or the 1-gram net-carb Hero Cheddar Biscuit. Don't give up being a breadhead. Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code TABLE at checkout. That's table at hero.co. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. So we were just talking with Lucas Sin, who loves Chinese-American restaurants so much. He wants to preserve the legacy of their food and buy out their elderly owners to give them a way to retire. And that conversation made me think of a trip I had last year, a visit to Kansas City, where I got to meet a family of restaurateurs of the sort that inspires Lucas. Only this one is staying in the game. Like, in a world where something approaching 90% of restaurants close in their first 5 years, the Ng family has been serving Chinese food at Bowling's restaurant for 4 decades. Now 3 generations in the family business. And at an event for the wonderful public radio station, KCUR, I got to interview Teresa, the mother, and her children, Rebecca and Raymond, on stage. And we start with the amazing matriarch, Teresa Ng.
So Teresa, since you are the matriarch, you're the mom, and I'm also Chinese, so I know how this is supposed to work.
Can we speak Chinese?
If you want, yeah.
No, I'm kidding. I will rather speak Chinese.
I know I'm supposed to honor elders, so I'm going to start with you first.
Okay.
When did you come to Kansas City?
We came into Kansas City, let me think, 1973. We came to, we moved to United States 1971, and we stayed in New York for a year and a half. Mm-hmm. And then my dad decided to move the whole family to Kansas City, and that was 1973.
Why? Why did they move here?
We were immigrants from Hong Kong and staying in New York, and my father and his buddy was searching location and tried to move a whole family to a place that is safe outside of New York. And so he...
we've cleaned up since then.
He have a,
You're welcome back anytime.
He have a friend who have a restaurant in Lawrence. So he's visiting his friend and decide that he liked Kansas City.
And he opened a restaurant?
Yes.
Wait, but your father had never worked in a restaurant before?
Yes, he worked in New York without, like, his whole family. We have four children and my mom, and we live in Hong Kong. And he was working here by himself and trying to get his whole family moved. Mm-hmm. And I, every time when I think about, I don't know how he lived in those days. And his restaurant owner was helping him to get the green card. And then he went back to Hong Kong and take a whole family to come to the United States.
Yeah.
And I was saying that I don't want to move. And I was like 12. Mm. And then my dad say, American is a heaven. It's a, you know, like a dream. Mm. And after we moved here for many years, I realized that, you know, if you work hard, if you, how I say it, that he's right. He really have bring his family to a place that feel like freedom and safe.
Mm. You know?
And my father is 93 years old now, and he's still living healthy. And there's six of us in our family. I was 16. My sister is 18, my older brother is 14, and my younger brother is 11. And we start dragging in. It's a family affair. We didn't hire anyone.
Yeah.
And since then, I was staying in the restaurant business.
Yeah. And at that time, was there much of a Chinese community here? Or?
No.
You can't. You don't have to think about it.
No. You can hardly see any Chinese.
Yeah.
And there's no grocery store. You can't even buy a napa cabbage. I remember, you know, there's every, I think it's Wednesday. I don't know where they from, but it's a big truck. Either, I think it's Chicago or New York or Los Angeles. And every week we will unload the vegetable and the fresh ingredients from a big truck. And take it back to the restaurant, you know.
Like, who was driving that truck? Like, it was like a magic Chinese food truck that just came.
I think there's they know that's needed. There's few restaurants here, maybe three or four Chinese restaurants that I know of that time.
It was just like a network.
Yeah, and when we first wait on table, we don't speak a word of English. Even now, I'm speak like Chinese and English because I'm staying in the restaurant almost every day, you know. And I skip school because I don't understand a word of what the teacher say.
Mm.
So I went with my mom to a sewing machine, that time a lot of new immigrant was the mother will sewing in the company, right?
Factory.
Yeah. And the father, the man, always worked in the Chinese restaurant.
Yeah.
And starting a Chinese restaurant is American dream for them at that time. And that leave for me, like, our generation, like, you don't get to pick, like, no choice. That's all you're going to do, you know? So I think no choice is the best choice.
Your children are right here. I'm going to talk to them in a second.
Well, they have choice. They have choice. They have a lot of choice.
Okay, so one last question. So in 1981, you with your husband, Richard, you opened Bowling's.
Yes.
Together as a couple. What did you try to do anything different with that restaurant than what your father had done with his restaurant?
We worked for our father for about 6-7 years. And I feel like My father is a hard work, and Richard is too. But because Richard go to school, and my father never went to school, mm-hmm. they work together, and they try to understand each other, but it's very difficult because it's different generation.
Sure.
So the way Richard want to do things different than my dad.
And what was different about it?
At that time, I don't know. I just know that we have to do something different.
Yeah.
We have to make a change.
Yeah.
So without much of experience, I was 23 when we start with Bowling's, and Rebecca's only 1 year old. Yeah, her daughter is almost a year old now.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Congratulations.
Thanks. And we decided that this is what we're going to do. We have to start our own business. And it was really, really difficult decision at that time because it's really hard to separate from your family, especially sure. in the old generation, Chinese family.
Sure.
And so we start with my dad is a great supporter. He helped me in financially. And our name is my father have choose Bo is my Richard's Chinese name. And my Chinese is Farling. So he designed that, let's go ahead and name Bowling's. So when we started, Richard still have a limited experience. Then my dad have to invite his good friend, a chef from New York, to come and help us. And Richard learned all the sauces and make all the like menus. And we start from there.
That's incredible. Okay, so
yes.
A little bit of context. That is an incredible honor. Because old school Chinese chefs mm-hmm. will never teach anyone anything.
Yes, yeah.
Like I'm going to go
so
to the
you
grave
know he's old.
With this recipe. I don't care who you are. So the fact that he helped you and helped your and
he
help
helped
Richard.
Us to start the recipe menu and everything. Yes.
Amazing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So let me turn now to your children, mm-hmm. Rebecca and Raymond. So you were one when Bowling's opened. Did you? I mean, grow up working in the restaurants.
I did.
Yeah.
I grew up, every memory that I have is in the restaurant. Either,
yeah.
either it was Dragon Inn or it was Bowling's. I just have a lot of fond memories of running around the restaurant and being in the back in everybody's way or being in the dining room, taking naps in the banquet space and talking to customers and...
And then when you started working in it, did something draw you to it? Or were you like, man, I got to get out of here one day?
No, I was very drawn to it.
Really?
I think to my parents' dismay. Yeah, I just had really fond memories and great experiences working there. And yeah, there was a definite point in my life where I thought, oh, this is what I want to do.
Really?
This is where I want to be. Yeah.
And you said to your parents' dismay.
Well, you know, I think that they had hoped that I would have chosen law school or medical school or...
Wait, are you Chinese?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Or that I would have, you know, done really well in school, but no, I did really well, you know, among the chaos of the restaurant life.
Yeah. And Raymond, you, did you have a similar experience?
I have a lot of memories. I didn't spend quite as much time in the restaurant as my sister did when I was really young. But I did spend a lot of time, you know, I took a few naps in the restaurant. I did a lot of homework at the bar, you know, watched TV while I waited for them to finish work. And then I worked in the restaurant, you know, once I was old enough to help bust some tables and run food and stuff like that. But I went to college, you know, swearing I would never work in the restaurant,
mm-hmm.
You know, and I wanted to get really, really far away. So I went to... I picked Virginia Tech because it was 1,000 miles away, and they accepted me. And then I took, but then after I got my degree, I decided that I missed home, that I liked coming home. The restaurant was comfortable.
You missed the food.
Yeah, I missed the food. but the restaurant was comfortable. It was what I knew. And, you know, even though it was kind of chaotic sometimes and a lot of stress, but yeah, it's what's comfortable.
Yeah, it's like you had your Rumspringa.
That's right.
But okay, so you're both working in the business now. And looking back to your parents' story and your grandparents' story, thinking about this restaurant that's been around literally as long as you've been alive, like, how do you feel about this legacy?
It's kind of surreal. When you grow up in the restaurant, you just it's all you know, it's normal. But it was sometime, I think, in middle school or high school when I realized that, you know, my parents had created something that was kind of, you know, extraordinary. Like, it was very, it's not normal, you know, not everyone's parents run a restaurant or, you know, are successful like they were. And then, you know, you see all the hard work that, you know, that it took to get there. And as we work in here more, I start to appreciate that, you know, unfortunately, there isn't any sort of, you know, secret other than hard work.
Yeah. What's in the sauce?
Work.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's kind of a stereotype, but unfortunately, you know, for us, it's true.
Yeah. Rebecca?
For me, it's just pretty amazing. Like my brother said, it's just, when you grow up in it, it's just kind of part of your normal life. But then as you meet different people and go to school and talk to everybody, and they're like, oh, yeah, we love Bolings. It's kind of like everybody knows it. And it's just incredible that they've made something that is a part of a lot of people's lives in Kansas City. Yeah. A lot of people celebrate their special holidays with us and or just, you know, come all the time. And yeah, it's just kind of incredible what they've built.
Yeah. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Teresa, Rebecca, and Raymond Ng, along with Teresa's husband, Bo, are the family behind Bo Ling's restaurants in Kansas City. And, you know, I actually didn't get a chance to go to their restaurant while I was in town. They did slip me some of their dumplings at the after party. They were terrific. But I can already tell you, I love their place. Because I love what it means. You know, when Teresa talked about, you know, having no choice when she entered the family business, I couldn't help but think of history and how, in a bigger way, a lot of early Chinese immigrants literally had no choice in what kind of business they would get into. If you've ever wondered why there's a stereotype of, you know, Chinese laundries or why there are so many Chinese restaurants, it's because that was all they were allowed to do. When Chinese immigrants first came to this country, nativist American men claimed that the Chinese were taking their jobs and they threatened Chinese workers with constant violence. And laundry and cooking, well, those were okay for them to do because those were considered women's work. Those were things that these men would literally never do, so it was fine for the Chinese. And so generation of Chinese immigrant after generation of Chinese immigrant took that degradation. And they made it work for them. I love them for it. Yeah, I'm here because of it. So thank you to the Ng family. Thank you to all the Gumas and Guzhengs who walked in that path and made it possible for me to be here. Thank you for listening to our show. Take care. We'll talk to you next week. You can listen to all of our podcasts on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get them, and sign up for a weekly email, Weeknight Kitchen. Gets a recipe straight to your inbox every Wednesday, makes dinner a little easier. It's at splendidtable.org. The show comes together with the help of our team, Jenny Lubke, Erica Romero, and Sally Swift. Stay safe, everyone. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.